You're listening to the Pandemic Podcast. We equip you to live the most real life possible in the face of today's crises. My name is Matt Botker, and I'm with my good friends, Dr. Stephen Kissler, an epidemiologist at the Harvard School of Public Health, and Dr. Mark Kissler, a doctor at the University of Colorado Hospital. Hey guys, welcome back. The trio is here. How's it going?
That's right. Good, good. It's good to see you.
Hey, yeah, it's good to be back. It feels good. You know, I was telling Mark and Stephen a couple, what was it, last week off the air. They're like, oh my gosh, maybe I said this already on the air. And if I did, I'm sorry. I feel like it's Groundhog's Day sometimes. I don't know what's going on, what's real, what's not real. That we're like, oh my gosh, it'd be so good. Someday we're all going to be together physically. I mean, it's weird that we haven't been together physically. It's been 33 episodes. And that I'm probably going to be teary-eyed when I see you guys physically. I'm like, it's going to be great. So we're all going to, let's do an episode live, like at a bar or someplace. That'd be so cool. And then I thought, like, oh yeah, by definition, our jobs are over if we go to a bar and do a podcast together on COVID, because either A, we're going against CDC policies, which it would then we're hypocrites, or hey, we're done. We're over the mountain. So
I will look forward to the day when we can do a concluding podcast at a bar, a crowded bar. That's what I'm looking forward to.
That would be awesome. Yeah. Yes. Well, you know, we're just so popular. I think we'll just do Mile High Stadium or something like that.
Yeah.
Know, something like that. Yeah, that'd be huge. Okay. So much to talk about. It's been a week. There's tons of news. For some reason, it's a particular one. Maybe July 4th. I have no idea. But we have a lot to talk about. We always need reviews. Thank you so much for those who've left them. If you can, leave a couple minutes. Just check the show notes. You can get the link right there to just leave a couple minute review, or even just click the stars, whatever you think is worthy. As well, patreon.com/pandemicpodcast. Always looking for financial support to help us pay off all the awesome equipment that we have to make things streamlined, easy, so we can edit, get this thing published on time, get it into your lovely ears. If you're not into a monthly recurring payment, Venmo, PayPal, just one-time gift, be so grateful for that. That's all in the show notes. And also, just as I said last week, I have my Momentum quarterly plan template. You can check out for free. Go to livingthereal.com/momentummatters. Pick it up. You'll get a series of emails to walk you through the process. You can do something great this quarter, make 2020 something worthy and memorable in maybe a really awesome way. And not so much a dreary way at times. Okay, let's get in. We have a lot to cover. I have a lot of in the news. We're going to do a deep dive on parascience. This is going to be great. This is where I kind of take a back seat once again, and I just probe Stephen and Mark about all the good stuff of parascience and what that really means and how we can decipher. I was just talking to you guys about how there's some things I read, and we have a pandemic podcast, and I'm like, oh, sounds good. It sounds persuasive. And if it's me, I mean, Lord knows who's, you know, everybody else in the world that's feeling the same weight of all this different information. Okay, let's get started. First thing, coronavirus cases are rising, which is really obvious, but apparently deaths are falling. So Stephen, like, what's the issue with this? Are we in a new transition? Have we beat coronavirus, or is something bigger in play?
Oh boy. So I think there's a couple things behind this. And yeah, so I think certainly from the beginning of the outbreak, you know, one of my colleagues said that actually one of the infection fatality rate in any given place is actually often not so much a measure of the severity of the illness, but basically how much testing we're doing. Because if you're going out and doing more tests, then you're basically your denominator. You're dividing the number of deaths by the number of cases. And if you have more cases, that's going to deflate the fatality rate, basically. So One reason why we're sort of seeing lower fatality rates is partly because we're just doing more testing. So we're catching a lot more of the cases that are less severe. That's kind of on the pessimistic side of the spectrum. On the optimistic side, I think we are probably getting better at treating it, you know, and our hospitals are not as overwhelmed in many places. And so I think there probably have been advances in the care for patients as well. The one that worries me the most is that we just haven't seen them yet. So we know very well that there's this delay between cases and severe illness and then ultimately death. And you can actually see this in many places. Like, look at New York City. The New York Times, for example, has these metrics where you have a graph of the number of cases over time and the deaths over time. And the cases started rising about 3 weeks before you saw any detectable rises in the deaths. And unfortunately, we've started seeing these spikes in different places around 2 to 3 weeks ago getting started. So my fear is actually that we just haven't seen them yet, and that it just takes a lot of time for a person to progress through these stages of illness. So I think that that's something we'll have to be paying very close attention to as we move forward. There's this real temporal aspect to this epidemic, right? And things don't always happen at the same time, and that can cause you to draw false conclusions from the data that's in front of you. So I think we need to be really mindful of that.
And of those three options, Which one are you, if you're a betting person, do you feel like has the most weight? Is it the more the lag time do you think is probably the issue?
I do. Yeah. I think that that's the biggest, probably the biggest factor, although all three of them are playing a role.
Sure. Sure. Okay. So hospitals struggle to contain COVID-19 spread inside their walls. Mark, have you experienced this? Is this something that's just kind of a news headline, or is this maybe a potential problem that's always been or new?
What I suspect, so I haven't read that particular article, but what I suspect that they're referring to is the fact that certain hospitals are having to reach out to neighboring institutions or to other facilities to help to house some of the patients. And so there was conversation, especially during the peak of our patient load in April when we were having that. We were talking about if we were going to need to maybe have some adult patients over at the Children's Hospital that's on our campus. I know that's been happening in Houston right now at the institution that I trained at, and in Texas Children's has been having some adult patients in their hospital facilities. And there's even been some conversations about, especially the patients for who have to stay, but who are medically stable, but maybe can't return to their rehab facility or nursing home or something like that because of a COVID positive status, where those patients could be cared for in a safe and effective way that's not in as resource of intensive of a setting as the hospital. So yes, there were definitely conversations about that here, and it's happening in certain other places, and you know, places are having to flex a little bit as the waves come and go in terms of patient volumes. And so yeah, it is something, you know, I think that we've seen and has been a big conversation amongst hospital leadership.
Okay, great. 9% of those who died from virus had other illnesses, Italy says. So I'm not sure what the point of this article was. It kind of was a little bit shocking to me. 99%. I saw the breakdown of this. Is this anything like new information? Does this have any kind of guidelines for us? Does this do anything for us in the U.S.? Or is this just kind of headlines again?
I mean, it's very much a headline, right? It's very much kind of geared towards that. And the immediate temptation is to extrapolate, like, well, what does that mean? I think it can mean, you know, a couple of things. One is that, you know, I'm not sure what percentage of individuals who die of any cause have other comorbidities, but it's a lot, you know, generally. So like just the general population, it's much more rare to die of something with no other comorbidity. And also, you know, I think it is helpful in the sense, is something that we know, right? Individuals with certain comorbidities are more susceptible to severe COVID-19 infections. That's been a constant throughout the course. But it's also potentially helpful in explaining some of the different mortality rates and different morbidity rates, you know, different degree of illness that we see amongst different populations and geographic locations and things like that. And so I think, you know, it's worth remembering. It's kind of a reminder. It seems to be a little bit more of a sensational statement of something that we already know. And, you know, I think the risk would be kind of flying then immediately to the conclusion of, well, we just let them go. They were sick anyway.
Exactly. You know? You got it.
And it's like, go. I mean, there are a lot of chronic illnesses that we live with. Lots of people live with, you know, young people, young, healthy people live with chronic illnesses too. And so, you know, I think in some ways that can be a little bit misleading in certain ways. So,
but it's helpful to realize that when you first read this article, my initial kind of reaction is this is a qualitatively different virus. But what you're saying is no, it's not qualitatively. It may be quantitatively, right? Most things are associated with degrees already have comorbidities already around them. This mm-hmm. might have a different threshold by which it you know, impacts the community, but it's in the same theme of other fatalities.
Yeah.
Great. Next one. We're going to hammer through these because I want to get to the parascience stuff. It'll be fun. Visual demo shows that effectiveness of masks and distancing. I just want to riff on this for a second because I have friends who really think masks are just a political statement. We know that there's in the government a lot of different disagreements on the purpose or the weight or the value of masks. What's going on right now? In March, we were kind of talking very loosely about masks and like, don't wear a mask. And now we realized to wear a mask because we realized because asymptomatic, pre-symptomatic. But now, and there also wasn't a lot of research on masks, but now a lot is being invested now at a very fast pace. Where are we at on the mask? To what extent do we see it providing value to prevent the spread of this virus? Stephen?
Yeah, so I think you're right. There is evidence that suggests that masks are probably helpful in reducing the spread of illness. And I think this might actually get into some of the parascience discussion that we're talking about in a moment. But I think a lot of the disagreements and arguments that I'm seeing right now are coming fundamentally from two places. One of them is, what do we accept as evidence? And the second is, how do we act in the face of evidence that we were given? So amongst a lot of the camps that really tend to be against wearing masks, tend to really focus on really gold standard randomized controlled trial type of evidence, really solid evidence. And in addition to that, suggest that we have basically a mandate to not change our behavior until there is evidence to support the change. And that unless there is strong evidence to support a change in behavior, then we ought to continue behaving as we have already. Now, on the other hand, another way of sort of on the other side of the spectrum are people who have sort of this proliferative notion of evidence, and that there are different shades of evidence. So, for example, you mentioned these videos and pictures of how people spread droplets, right? Like, that's not a randomized controlled trial, but that is a certain type of evidence that suggests that droplets don't spread as much or as far when you're wearing a mask. And so, sure, that doesn't tell us directly how much transmission is going to be reduced by wearing a mask, but it does suggest a very plausible mechanism by which masks could reduce the spread of disease. And then, in the face of that evidence, the decision is, well, we have this balance of benefits and risks, and we recognize that while there isn't necessarily this solid, you know, unequivocal evidence that masks will absolutely reduce spread, there is a very strong reason to believe that they might. And if you weigh that with the risks of wearing a mask, it seems like that probably, you know, to this perspective, really outweighs, you know, it's basically like, well, we might as well try, you know, right? It's yeah, like, sure, we might as well give it a shot. And so it's a different way of reading the evidence and a different way, a different philosophy really about how to respond to the evidence that you see. And so that's really what I'm seeing right here is, and I think that that can explain a lot of the divides and disagreements that we've seen throughout the epidemic.
Kind of this, when you first start off, it's like a courtroom scene, kind of it's like innocent until proven guilty, where it's just like, no, until it's absolutely proven that it completely mitigates the spread of this virus, and I am not going to take it, which is one way to look at it, but also prevents the opportunity to at least lower it a little bit by taking on some benefits of it.
Right.
Again, it's complicated, and it's okay. It's okay. It's complicated. Yeah. Which I think a lot of these headlines, Stephen, Mark, you talked about this off the recording, are kind of aligned in this area. The problems of these are just that the complexity of that. We're all looking for this little bucket that we can put ourselves in, and it's just not faring well for us to put these things in buckets, and it's causing divide. I look at this next one, which is, again, it's the same. Reminds me of, okay, so. Little tangent. My wife and I were dating at the time. We were looking at the ocean. It was beautiful, romantic, captivating. And we were talking about how, you know, could anybody ever look at an ocean and say, oh, this is nauseating? Like, you just couldn't, right? And so then we came this new line in that spirit of like Eeyore. Look at the ocean, like, same wave, different day, you know, like this is like this idea of like that it's just like this kind of mentality of seeing this. So I don't even know where I was going with this. I totally got in the middle. Where was I on this? Where was I going? We know.
I share you in that bewilderment. I can stand with you.
I really
you
had a good point. I was going to land this plane and it was going to skyrocket our rate. But we're done. So
no, let me think. I mean, you were talking about probably the seeing kind of the same patterns over and over again. Is that mm-hmm. where you were at? Is it? I don't know.
Maybe so. I don't know. We're gonna let it go.
All right.
By the end of this episode, I'm gonna come right back to it. I'll remember.
we're gonna land it really.
We're landed. Yeah, really I promise good. You guys. Stay tuned. This is my hanging. You do have to get some kind of cliffhanger to keep people into the end. This is my cliffhanger.
You got me.
So I got you. We'll be. Stay tuned. So, related to this idea of the complexity, and it's complicated, the hydroxychloroquine helped save coronavirus patients, study shows. Just a few weeks ago, Mark, you were just chatting about how, hey, oh, this is big news, came about, that's not really that effective. Now we're seeing this. And no, it is effective. Seems to contradict. What's going on here?
Yeah, so I have not. I'll do a deep dive on this study, and maybe we can talk about it next week. Because this is the first time that it's kind of hit my radar. But I did do kind of a cursory look at it before we talked, and so a couple things about this study that are interesting. So it's a pretty big study. It's multi-center, both of which, it's a little over 2,000 patients, it looks like, were included. And so we've talked about that, you know, as we're building higher rigor of scientific evidence, having multi-center trials, having large numbers of patients involved tend to be helpful. It is an observational study. So that was something we talked about last time, that we really need prospective randomized control trials to determine causation rigorously. And observational retrospective studies can determine some correlation. And it seems, at least in my gloss of this, that they had a pretty decent effect size with this population. And so this is what I see here are a couple of things. This to me is very typical of kind of the march of our scientific understanding. So we have small studies, we have observational studies, we have conflicting evidence between a study that was done here and a study that was done there. We look at the methods, and over time, eventually we develop enough of an understanding, or we do a big enough randomized control trial to really establish a standard of care. And what we saw early with the hydroxychloroquine evidence was that they were not, you know, necessarily excellently designed studies, that there were some issues with some of the methodology, or they were small, or things like that. And so again, we didn't have, sort of as Stephen was talking about, that body of compelling evidence to totally change our clinical practice with regards to that. Does that mean necessarily that there is zero effect size? Not necessarily. Also, does it mean that the effect size is as big as was shown in this most recent study in all populations? Probably not, or maybe not. And so more, and this is just how science unfolds. It's often unfolds with less public scrutiny. And what's interesting to me, I think, in particular about the hydroxychloroquine question, is how there seem to be these teams that have been declared, where there's the hydroxychloroquine team and the hydroxychloroquine doesn't work team. And that adds this whole other layer on top of what is, you know, at least in my side, kind of the typical progression of how we understand therapeutic options, where it's like, oh, you know, we scored one for the hydroxychloroquine team, or we like, you know, it's like, you know, somebody's sitting on the, you know, in the penalty box on the, you know, on that. And it's just like, I don't know if that's particularly helpful. I guess I don't feel like it's particularly helpful. I find it interesting, I guess, if you can find something that's painful, interesting at the same time, you know, that's, I guess, but it's not particularly helpful, because I think it serves to obscure sort of the nuance about how do we make these difficult clinical decisions and do the best by our patients. You know, I don't want to put every sick patient on every single drug that's been mentioned as potentially having a therapeutic benefit, because that could do harm. You know, I put somebody who's already sick on a bunch of new medications that they've never seen before. I want to pick the one that has the best effect size and the most, you know, it at their point in illness. And that just takes a little bit higher resolution data than we have. We're getting there. We're in a much, much better place than we were in March and April. And this is the process. We're just in that process.
Yeah, I agree with the whole hydroxychloroquine pursuit. It just feels like it's a loaded particular treatment. There's a lot of politics behind this, and it's like whoever wins, whatever's underneath that associated, whatever platform is underneath that, wins the entire platform, right? There's this fight for, and so it's a weird reality. And you could see, again, it's the whole parascience. We're kind of already unfolding this reality of there is this march towards advocating the necessity that hydroxychloroquine wins the day, which means everything else behind that banner wins the day as well. And we're trying to fight for that. And this is creating the complexity of the whole situation. So yeah, I it's amazing how this keeps showing up, and there's this internal fight for ideologies. 239 scientists call on WHO to recognize coronavirus as airborne. Weeks ago, a couple months ago, we talked about there's been airborne and the particles, and now we're seeing this kind of renaissance of going deeper into whether this might be airborne. Is this something we should be concerned about, Mark?
Just to kind of recap what we had talked about before. So when we talk about, in a clinical sense, droplet spread versus airborne spread, droplets are typically larger particles that spread over shorter distances, that gravity grabs them and drags them down to the floor more easily. They don't float in the air as long and require sort of a different level of personal protective equipment to prevent the transmission. Whereas airborne particles are smaller, they hang in the air much longer and kind of require a higher degree of protection. There are things that can be done that aerosolize pathogens that are typically spread with droplets. And so if you have a droplet spread disease, and then you're doing something like positive pressure, so we call it BiPAP or CPAP, which is essentially a mask that's put on that provides a back pressure that helps with breathing, intubation procedures, even the procedure of a nasal swab for the testing can aerosolize the secretions. Coughing, sneezing can create, you know, more aerosolized particles. But I would think of it more of as a spectrum, you know, that they're in a droplet, a disease that's predominantly spread through large respiratory droplets. Some particles can be smaller and linger in the air longer, and particularly if there's a lot of aerosolizing things going on at the time. And so it's much less kind of we think of this as an either or category, but there are instances in which both can be true. And as we're making tough decisions around scarcity of resources and things like that, and also just kind of the practical nature of how do we prevent spread within the communities, I think it's important to remember that there is a little bit of a continuum between those categories. And so, will a cloth face mask protect the wearer against something that is aerosolized, you know, not as effectively, but does it prevent the number of viral particles that person is transmitting into the atmosphere that could potentially protect other people? And so again, that's just the nuances of the conversations around how this is spread. I don't know, Stephen, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I think it's exactly that. You can think about it from the epidemiological scale for sure too, that a lot of the distinctions that I've seen or confusion that I've seen is, you know, is this important to spread is the question. And it's like, well, what do you mean by spread and what do you mean important? Could you get it through an aerosolized viral, you know, transmission? Absolutely. Is that route predominant? Like if we were able to stop all droplet spread, would the aerosolized spread still be able to sustain epidemics? Probably not. You know, and so it's like from an epidemiological perspective, yes, droplets are probably the most important route of spread and are the ones that are really driving epidemics. But nevertheless, you know, there is this other route that still can cause infections for sure.
Great. So I think for me, this doesn't really have a practical implication when it comes to new CDC guidelines or anything like that. I mean, the fact that the WHO might recognize this is not going to change really anything that we're practically doing.
No, I don't see it. Yeah, it is a big change.
Great. Well, here's some really good news for all of you who are not horseshoe crabs. So listen in. So apparently horseshoe crabs' blood is the key to making COVID-19 vaccine. Mark, Stephen, I don't think they had a clue about this. I saw it on this. I do this for inspiration for all of you who are human beings and not crab shoes listening to this podcast right now, that be thankful you're a human and not a crab shoe, a horseshoe crab, because they are about to be mined.
If you needed another reason for that.
For that inspiration, to be thankful to be human. Right, there's another one. But do outside of that inspiring note of our humanity and not being a horseshoe crab, is there anything here that you guys know about that what this is coming from? Dead silence. So
that's a little outside my scope.
Man, yep, that's fine. We're good. So let that be just a moment of inspiration.
Let that be what it is. Yep.
Okay. A couple more small things now. COVID-19 outbreak at University of Washington, Greek Row. I think this really kind of hints of this idea of the complexity of fall when school resumes, particularly with, I would say, universities. I mean, any school is going to have it, but universities, we know it's a time for exploration, hangouts, connection, those kind of things. I can't imagine college students wearing masks to their parties, that kind of stuff. So I expect in the midst of the natural tendency we're seeing with rises in cases among states at university towns like Boulder, Colorado, I think in particular for me, in my mind, because it's a small town. It's a small town that when college comes, I feel like it nearly doubles the size of the town, right? So that's a large population coming in that has a different kind of culture right behind it. So I imagine this fall is going to be. Stephen, is that kind of the similar expectations you guys are seeing or talking about at Harvard?
Yeah, definitely. I think, we're watching these sorts of things pretty closely. And anytime you bring a lot of people together, there's, you know, a very good chance of outbreaks getting started again. So yeah. I think that you're right. Universities in the fall are especially a big point of concern.
Yeah. Okay. I saw this article. It was interesting. Fever checks can't catch all, which is, I think, common sense, COVID-19 cases, but smell tests might help. Mark, what kind of process would this be and how could this help?
Yeah. One of the weird things about this virus is that it seems in a lot of cases to affect taste and smell, as well as, you know, our typical upper respiratory or lower respiratory tract infectious symptoms like cough, fever, chills, and then also the GI stuff. So diarrhea. So all of that we know. This is interesting to me in the sense that, so something I like to think of when I'm making diagnostic decisions in the hospital are the likelihood ratios that are associated with various tests or maneuvers that we do. So for instance, if you have somebody who comes in with a cough, there's a lot of things that can cause a cough. And I can start to narrow my differential based on the likelihood ratio of various tests. And so, you know, say I'm trying to figure out if it's a pneumonia or if maybe they have too much fluid on their lungs because they have a heart problem. And there's different things that I can do, you know, and, you know, every physical exam maneuver has more or less a likelihood ratio, every lab test, every radiology study. Now, all of these aren't necessarily perfectly defined, but you can get a general sense of, is this a good test that helps to narrow the differential diagnosis? So does that kind of concept make sense? The thing that's interesting to me about the likelihood ratios is that you can actually stack them. So if you have multiple tests in a row and you know the likelihood ratio of each, and that, you know, say you have a positive test here and then the next test you do is also positive, now you can stack the likelihood of arriving at the proper diagnosis. And so that's what I see going on here is, sure, fever's not going to catch everybody and it never would. But if you stack another test that has a favorable likelihood ratio, and that's also, you know, positive or negative in a way that's helpful, now all of a sudden we're gaining more resolution in terms of our ability to catch what's going on or see somebody who potentially is early in the course of illness and might benefit from not going to work that day. So it's good. It seems like sound advice. You know, I think implementation is going to be tough. I don't know if we like mail scratch and sniffs out to like everybody exactly. Or what. Yeah.
But it's like tricking with like a scratch stiff poo sticker.
Right. Well, I'm sure
my boys would love
all
it.
Sorts of, right. Yeah. Right.
You'd freshly be thankful you didn't smell
maybe
that
we could
one.
Do freshly cut grass.
There we go. That's more humane. Yeah, okay. That's good. So, okay, before we get into the deep dive, your third grade teacher we talked about last week emailed us. Thank you, Kirsten, for emailing. It's good to hear from her. I heard some great stories.
It's so great to hear. It's just like really, it reminds me of a lot of the good memories that I had in that class and also at the elementary school in general. I just had the teachers there were super awesome and supportive, and she is, you know, one of the examples of the best of the best. So it was super cool to get back in touch with her this way.
It's been fun to read them, and I won't obviously read it for keep their humility, but I learned a lot. These two cats are incredibly intelligent, smart people that even at kindergarten, I think they were probably reading college level, you know, literature, that kind of stuff. So
getting lost at assemblies. But.
So there's a practical wisdom component.
Those two go together, guys. I mean, really smart people oftentimes get lost. So
I hope my wife's listening to this episode. We'll talk about that. It's a running issue in our family is my sense of direction.
Sure. But she had some good questions. She is a teacher, teaches homeschool stuff and science, and I don't know all the gist of it, but she has some concerns coming up this fall that I want to throw. One thing is struggling with the idea of students or teachers getting sick and what to do. And I could see that. I mean, it's fall. Kiddos are going to get sick and they're going to have, like you just said, I think it's a great segue to that stackable thing. They're going to have all the symptoms, the runny nose, the cough, the diarrhea. Do you just close up shop every time that happens? Otherwise you're going to get nowhere. So she's looking for some guidance of like, what do we do when we see a student or a teacher get sick and still keep our classes going? Any insight?
Yeah, I think I'm interested to hear what Steven's thinking, because I think there's a couple questions here. One of them is how much are we concerned about the transmission that's going on amongst pediatric populations in general, and what that's going to do potentially for populational rates? Because as we've talked about, this is kind of a somewhat unique pathogen in the way that it affects kids. And so I think I'm interested in hearing that. And I think we can riff a little bit on some of these things. Maybe Stephen, you've been involved in some specific conversations with that. You know, I've seen some of what our Denver Public School District is doing based on the recommendations of our local public health experts. But it seems like this is something where if one is in a position to be making these decisions, that you should seek out a lot of different opinions and a lot of different models about how this is going on, and then try and adapt that best you can to what makes sense given your own constraints and things like that. So I think that there, this is one of those tricky things where there may not be one best answer for the specific situation that you're in. But if you see what all the, you know, all the school districts around you are doing, what some of the experts, you know, like from public health places like Stephen are recommending, things like that, then maybe you can come up with something that's as good as possible, given the, you know, all of the things that we have to weigh in this time. So I don't know, Stephen, you have any thoughts initially just about kind of like schools and how to handle things like sick kids, social distancing in the classroom, stuff like that?
Right. I mean, it, definitely like depending on the size of the school or the organization, I mean, there are different opportunities to have conversations with probably, I mean, in this case, probably the parents and sort of just like the level of risk that you as a small community are willing to deal with, and what sorts of communication do you want when someone does become infected, and what sort of provisions will there be for students who, you know, if their parents decide they want to take them out of class for a while for the protection of their family, like how do we deal with that? And so I think, you know, every action that we have is going to come along with some level of risk, whether it be from infection with COVID or something else. And so I think just being upfront about that fact, and then just thinking about sort of like what are the levels of risk that we're willing to tolerate, and what sorts of, you know, behaviors can we then partake in given those levels of risk? And how can we allow people to sort of also choose which levels of risk they're comfortable with within this broader community to allow like broad participation? So I think that's one way of looking at it. I do hope that over the next few months, you know, people are really getting their heads together to think in particular about how to bring schools back safely. And there's just some work that recently came out. Actually, it was led in part by a professor at CU Boulder, Dan Larimore, shout out to him, and with collaborators back here at Harvard School of Public Health, and talking about how, you know, there are very cheap tests for COVID, the paper-based tests, but their sensitivity is really bad. So you might take the test and still get a negative even if you're infected. But the idea is that this is similar to what Mark was talking about building up, you know, sort of the increase in these likelihoods, that if you're taking the test repeatedly, if these tests are being done every day or every 3 days, and everybody in a community is doing them, you can still catch outbreaks very early, and then you can make decisions based on that. And so this sort of like paradigm of rapid, cheap testing, even if the accuracy isn't that great, is one thing that is really being considered. And I'm hoping there will be an ability to sort of bring these sorts of things into implementation in schools and universities this fall to sort of help us constrain outbreaks before they get too large.
Is there, before we go to the next question, is there anything like the CDC? I mean, Mark, you were saying there's schools who are tackling this problem, but it seems like this is like a national problem that needs to be addressed at some central location, saying exactly what you said, Stephen, like that's a great idea incorporated with two or three other things can help really limit the amount of transmission. Is there any place you guys are aware of that's like, I mean, Harvard, do you guys have a plan that they're doing research, or does somebody have something that we can present in the show notes, or something like, here's an idea by which you can engage an educational system and mitigate the transmission in a pretty easy way, a 1-2-3 way?
Yeah, I don't have any resources off the top of my head, but I do know where I would look for them. So okay. I'll do a little bit of research into that after the podcast and see if we can post
them. And we'll put them in the show notes, and or those we'll talk about next week, or at least put it in next week.
Yeah.
Next one, she was talking about the idea that a lot more people using bleach and sanitizers. I see it on Facebook, all these kind of alcohol exposures, a lot of chemicals. Her concern is, will this bring a rise in cancer later on? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is there a threat to this?
Mark? I tend to think of the risk of bleaches and alcohols to be more of a kind of a short-term exposure risk. So with things like ingestions, or, you know, if you were to aspirate some of it and you get some inflammation in the lungs or things like that, these are not substances. There, you know, there are substances that we know are really carcinogenic, and long-term exposure to those can create an increased rate of cancers. But in terms of the sanitizing chemicals, particularly bleaches and alcohols, I think of those more in terms of just their immediate risk. You know, that they can be kind of caustic or irritating. You know, kids, you have to always watch, make sure they don't put things in their mouth and stuff like that. But it's less a risk. You know, they're not known to be highly carcinogenic chemicals that we're using. So, you know, the chance of causing cell transformations that lead to cancer later is a much lower risk. It's not really something, it's not at the level of a risk that I would even worry about.
Okay, great. Which leads to the last question, which is similar. And I think her concern about mask wearing for a long period of time. I know I've had a couple people share the same concern and why they're not wearing masks. They've heard that long-term masks can create tons of lung issues down the road, and that 5-10 years from now, we're going to have this a new epidemic of lung issues that are going to be chronic. And then on top of this, shucks about, you know, try to get kindergartners to wear masks all day. They use them as puppets, right? They're not going to put them around their face. So what are the long-term effects of this? And is this something that could be concerning down the road?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's, so the short-term effects, I'm just anticipating what it's going to look like to have my kids trying to wear a mask all day long. You know, and we were like, we're going to need like 8 masks a day. You know, they're going to get ketchup on them and they're going to like drop them accidentally in the gutter. And like, this is just going to be a thing. It's going to be tough, you know? And again, I think remembering that a mask is not the only or magic bullet, but this is just one in the chain of all the things that we try to do to help each other out. And, you know, it's one of the things that's uncomfortable that we can hopefully tolerate a little bit. And every time we do, maybe it helps some, and it's not going to be the single variable that changes, you know, everything. But as much as we can do it, it could be potentially helpful, you know, in the school settings. We'll see. I've seen a lot of conversations about the risks, you know, that this poses a bigger health risk than infectious diseases. And so I think where I have seen, I was trying to figure out where that was coming from, you know, where this idea, because we have like surgeons wear masks all day long at work, you know, all the time. And that's not something like, it's not as if we see higher rates of chronic lung disease necessarily in, you know, that kind of population. So I'm just kind of trying to figure out what the concern of the mask is. And it seems what I've seen is at least it's coming down to the ideas of lower oxygen levels being inhaled or higher levels of carbon dioxide. And so those are two kind of classic pulmonary issues, right? Hypoxia and hypercarbia, as we call them. And so, yeah, it is bad, you know, to not get enough oxygen or to get too much carbon dioxide in general, but there are ways that our body compensates for slightly reduced levels of those. So the way I think about like a hypoxia, I actually, to be honest with you, I think of hypoxia, the low oxygen levels, as a much lower, it's almost negligible with the masks, because if you think about it, you're sucking in the room air through the mask and it's not filtering out oxygen molecules. So the percentage of oxygen molecules that get in through the mask are the same as are on the outside of the mask. And even if it was a little bit lower, would be comparable to maybe going to altitude or something, because that's another common scenario in which we encounter fewer O2 molecules floating around, is just when we go to altitude. And we tend not to worry about that when we go up for weeks at a time, even, because our body compensates for a lower level of inhaled, you know, fractional oxygen. Hypercarbia is a little bit of a different issue. So we breathe out carbon dioxide, and the mask potentially can trap some of that in the area close to our nose and our mouth where we're breathing it in, and we're recycling that more. One of the ways that our bodies, when we're healthy, compensates for that is you just increase the amount that you're breathing. And so by increasing your tidal volume or your respiratory rate, you're blowing off more carbon dioxide, and you can help to compensate. And our body does a really good job when we're healthy of compensating for that and making sure that we maintain, you know, a safe physiologic level of carbon dioxide in our bodies. There are certain individuals, especially those who have very, very severe, like chronic obstructive pulmonary disease or emphysema or something like that, who are already hypercarbic at baseline, for whom having a mask on has a theoretical risk of maybe pushing them a little bit more over the edge in that direction. But these are folks that I think of generally as, you know, these are individuals who are very sick from a respiratory standpoint to begin with. And, you know, for them, weighing the risks and benefits, those might be individuals who might have to focus more on really close social distancing. It's a little misleading. On very attentive social distancing, right? Because they don't want to get it at all because of the baseline lung disease. I guess I tend to think of the degree, the amount that we're wearing masks and the amount that we can breathe through the masks and sort of the permeability of the cloth and paper masks that we're talking about using most of the time as not posing a big risk in kind of a global populational hypercarbia lung issues showing up in the next few years. That seems less likely given sort of, you know, everything that we've seen and what we understand about masks.
Great. Steve, anything to add about that epidemiology? No, it seems kind of strange for this kind of information being presented out and this concern. After all, because I'm like my surgeon, I would never want my surgeon to be lightheaded at any point.
I agree with that.
I really want him to be particularly on his game on that day. So.
And they are uncomfortable. You know, I think there's all these other social things, right? It feels uncomfortable. Yeah. It creates this barrier interpersonally. It's this thing you're wearing on your face that's sort of a symbol of, that I think people feel it's either a symbol of fear or it's a symbol of compliance or a symbol of like being a good citizen or symbol of being, you know, whatever. So I think that all those things get wrapped in, you know, the one other thing I've heard mentioned is that it lowers your immune function, that it makes your immune system not work to wear a mask. And that I'm not, like, I can't tie a physiologic explanation to that claim. I don't know exactly where that would be coming from. As far as I can tell, that's just totally false, that there's no direct effect on the immune system related to wearing a mask, though that's something I've seen come up a lot of times. So, okay.
Well, speaking of parascience, so let's talk about this for a few minutes, because it's concerning to me. So how this came about was about 3 weeks ago, I read an article, or I didn't get it all the way through it, called Lockdown Lunacy, The Thinking Person's Guide. Yeah, The Thinking Person's Guide, right? So, and it went through a number of facts. It's all based on science, and I think had a decent amount of footnotes behind it. And I read it, and even having this podcast, it was rather convincing. So I threw it to Mark and Steven. They kind of looked it over, and this is where we came. Mark presented the idea of talking about parascience, that taking scientific information, right, and kind of recalculating in such a way to present a particular conclusion. And so what I want to throw to you guys is I want to know the difference between, so I took some philosophy classes and the pre-Socratics, and you had this idea of sophistry and this whole argument, like what is true? And then you had the sophists come on, and they believe that pretty much the truth doesn't really exist, and it really is all rhetoric and art of persuasion. So it's kind of taking information and presenting it in such a way that you can really persuade someone into your side. And that's sophistry. And so I kind of know what's between sophistry and science, because it's hard for me even to distinguish, because when I read this stuff, it seems logical. It seems to flow. Yet when we talk about things, once we get into the podcast, I'm like, oh, okay, I see. How can we help our listeners see the difference? You know, I just see, you know, Rand Paul on top of this, not helping the situation, and, you know, understanding kind of where he's going, basically saying not to trust the experts. And a lot of the reasons, because, you know, he proposes, or at least the article that talks about his quote, is that this idea that experts have such a narrow niche by which they can many times, or maybe sometimes, not include some other information that needs to be included, or they go beyond the scope of their expertise and say things they're not qualified to say, which then errs and they make conclusions that are wrong and not comprehensive. So thus, don't trust the experts. So we have don't trust the experts. We had this idea of parascience, people coming together. How do we know the difference in between parascience and science itself?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the big questions that's going on right now. And we're all trying to figure out, we're just seeing the effects of that big time. So parascience is a term that you guys know that I really like. Marilyn Robinson, who's kind of novelist, essayist, public intellectual, and she derived that term in one of her books. And so I think the way that we're using the term may be a little bit less, just for the sake of precision of language, is a little bit different from the way that she was using it. But the idea is still being that you're using scientific language and you're appealing to a certain scientific authority, but you're actually promoting or using that to promote something that's not necessarily scientific, but is really a philosophical position, but claiming that it's science says that. And this is, you know, it's super tricky, and this becomes very slippery, especially in matters of health and public health. And so I think we've talked a lot about the ways that this is complicated. I think, you know, when I look at an article like the one that you sent that kind of goes here, you know, study by study or abstract by abstract, this abstract says this, therefore, you know, and then sort of weaves together sort of a meta narrative about what is true and what is not true. I think the misleading thing is just the way that different bits and pieces of evidence are used to create what seems to be a coherent narrative, whereas each of those bits and pieces of evidence sort of exist in their own setting, in their own context. You know, some of them are more and less rigorous. Some of them are speaking to slightly different problems than they might be, you know, seen to be speaking to. But then you kind of piece those together in a craftily rhetorical way to make a case that can seem very compelling from the outset. So that's kind of naming the problem and naming sort of this category, or trying to flesh out what we're meaning when we're talking about that you're using that word parascience. So I don't know, maybe I'll throw it to Stephen for a little bit and see if he has any thoughts sort of specifically about, to your question, Matt, of how do you tell the difference or what does this mean? You know, even granted that a lot of our scientific decisions and policy decisions are not quite so siloed, you know, that there are a lot of things that are kind of going back and forth right now in both of those worlds. Stephen, how do you approach some of those things?
Yeah. So, I mean, one thing that comes to mind is that there's, in thinking about the distinction between science and parascience, from one perspective, we're all kind of engaged in a parascience of sorts, because there are, just by virtue of our own histories and our own presumptions about what constitutes evidence, we're going to favor certain types of evidence over others. We're going to simply omit bits of evidence because we don't know about them. And that will lead to the perspectives that we have as experts, as scientists about a certain thing. But I think that actually calling it parascience takes one step further, because I think that implies also a certain intentionality about it as well. And I think that's, you know, that's again important, because science, you know, we think about science as, you know, this sort of, it oftentimes this very pure thing and this thing that's based on facts, but really science is just another field of narrative. And we're all trying, you know, the only way that we can communicate science and the only way that we can interpret science is in the context of a narrative, because that's just how our minds work. And so necessarily all of us as scientists, when we're writing papers, we're writing stories. We're writing stories about what we think the evidence is showing us. That I think the most important thing is, you know, trying to, as a scientist, to be your own strongest critic. And I think that there's a certain amount of intellectual rigor and honesty that comes with that. And that's a real challenge and something that I'm still very much working on and in training for. But there's, you know, the most important thing you can do as a scientist is to try to break down your own arguments. And I think that's the best safeguard as a scientist against producing things that are like parascience.
Oh, yeah. I want to go back to that idea in some of the intellectual humility and stuff like that, but I want to put a little pressure or just push back a little bit on this idea that science is another narrative. Cause I think that can be misleading. You know, I think for someone who's steeped in like rigorous science, you can say that and, you know, and be kind of engaged in thinking about it that way and in a fruitful way. But I think it's important to say that there are some pretty important differences too between science and storytelling or science and, you know, all these other things, that there are appeals to objective evidence. Right. And so I want to just make sure that we don't go too far in terms of just saying like, you know, science is just another story that we can tell about the world. Right.
Right. Right. It's a story that is sort of subservient to and answers to the world in a particular way. It's like a story that's tested and a story that changes if, you know, if your observations don't align with what the story is saying. So it's like, I think maybe a better way of saying that is that the tools of narrative allow us to communicate our science and to understand our science.
There we go. I like that.
Right.
Yeah.
Like that's the thing. But yeah, that's it. It's the way of like interpreting and understanding what's happening.
Right. I like that. I think keeping those categories a little bit distinct in the sense that science is this thing that corresponds to the world, that is testable, that has a certain objectivity to it. Right. But then in translating that science immediately, you know, to a way that we understand, we're already employing the tools that we use to understand other things in our lives. The foremost of which is narrative and story, right? And so I think just to create a little bit of distinction between those categories, if that's fair. Mm-hmm. Cool.
Yeah,
and so I think, and your point then is well taken, that in what we're calling parascience, there's an intentionality to creating a narrative that the commitment there is not necessarily that it is an accurate representation of the world, but rather that it's the accurate representation of an idea or a position. And that's kind of a different potential frame to using scientific language and writing.
Right.
Is that fair? I want to make sure. Do you think, Matt? I just want to throw that half back to you before we launch into the next part.
No, I think that's great. I mean, before I go on, Stephen, do you have anything to add? Do you continue on before your thoughts, before I have a couple things?
Yeah, maybe just one last thing, which is you're talking about distinguishing between science and parascience. And I think that bearing these tools of narrative in mind can be very important, because I think that sometimes the the most obvious way that parascience shows itself is in the way in which those tools of narrative are employed. And so, for example, in the article that we were talking about here and many other articles that I think I would classify as parascience, there is sort of this notion of saying, basically, this is how things behave, and this is how this acts, and this doesn't act this way, and it is this, and not this. And I think that that's a very unscientific way of writing, not because it's not the style of science, but because it's not the way the world works. Because the world is almost basically never, you know, even see how I said that, right? I was going to say the world is never so cut and dry, but I don't even speak in those kinds of absolutes, right? I'm not even so sure that the world is not absolute that I'll say it absolutely, that the world is not absolute, right? Like that's the kind of scientific sort of like that. I think science sort of shapes your mind and your worldview in that way. And so as if you're reading a narrative that has those kinds of absolutes, I think that's what starts ringing alarm bells for me, because true scientific writing is always steeped in caveats and complexity, because I think that's the most honest way of seeing the world. And so if you don't see that, then that's, I think it's a good clue that maybe there's something else going on.
Yeah. And I think I might make the distinction between absolutes and complexity. I think that so one of the things I'm thinking of is that when you come to science and the difference between science and parascience. Now, again, this is out of my pay grade, but so I'm going to use my master's here to a story that came from this. And, you know, for me, I feel like parascience, the priority is over story, over science. Whereas I think science is the priority is over science, over story. Now here's my best illustration I can get to this. I was presenting a thesis for my master's, and I was studying in Greek, and I was trying to explain this logical transition in this book. And I was trying to show that this word, this Greek word, was a logical transition and not a temporal transition. So it's all technical, right? So I was trying to argue this case, and I did it pretty well. And then some guy, and I didn't have the right answer at this point in time, so I looked like an idiot. So, but in hindsight, I'm like, oh, I should have said this. I would have won the case, right? So I explained my case that this is a logical transition. But, and so then the guy raised his hand and says, well, if that's a logical transition, if you're saying that this is all about a logic, premise A to premise B, then why is there temporal language in the first part? And if you think it's logical, and I didn't have an answer. And I was like, oh, I'm an idiot. Of course, there's temporality. Just because they call it a logical transition doesn't mean that there's not temporality. There's actually things that deal with time in an argument. What I was trying to advocate is that the focus for the transition is a logical focus, not a temporal transition, which for many people are thinking this makes no sense. But for the argument, it hinged on this. Like for my case, it hinged on this. And I wasn't trying to say either or. I'm just saying, yes, they both exist. But the emphasis for the person's argument is on a logical transition. And so for my mind, I'm thinking maybe this is kind of the thing between parascience and science. It's the emphasis. Whereas when I look at this lockdown lunacy article, it seems that really the focus is story. I'm trying to portray a story, right? That has a particular conclusion, and I'm going to find science to try and back that story. Versus the I'm going to do science and then do my best to do science, and then from that science, I'm going to weave and fabric a story from that data. Would that be a fair assessment, or is that oversimplification?
Yeah, I think that's good. I'll have to think about it a little more, but I like that. And especially in terms of just the initial kind of the sense, like when you're, if you're talking about practically, how do you start to make that distinction of just like, just being attentive to questions of like genre and the way that this story is being told and in what serves what, you know, is the science being made to serve this kind of overarching argument or otherwise? It's complicated. It's super complicated, but I think that could be a helpful way of thinking about it.
Yeah. And I think it's like a story as being a thing that softens the edges of life. And it really needs to do that, right? The purpose is to tell a story that you can comprehend, an edginess you can't comprehend. So again, the best way I can explain this are my sons. I teach them paratruth. Okay. And the reason why I teach them paratruth is because they can't really handle all the science behind some of the stuff. We just talked about camels yesterday, about how they can hold water. And for my son, they never drink water. They just won't drink water because they can go for such a long time for him in his mind. They go such a long time drinking water, they just don't drink water. I can't convince them. But I'm like, fine. You know what? We'll get to this. Paratruth is okay right now. Simply, I have a story about a camel that goes 8 or 9 months without drinking water. He never drinks water, right? So it's okay. That's the story. And as he grows, I can fill it with more science and then reform the story in light of the science that he can comprehend. You know, I'm kind of thinking in that that method. Again, does that ring a bell to anybody, or am I just in my own world right now, loving what I'm thinking?
I mean, what I hear, I think, is what it is that we're all in it, you know, all of us, including, I think, a lot of our listeners too, are in this process of trying to engage with a lot of honesty what's going on around us, right? And so there's lots of different ways and metaphors we can make about how do we come to a collective understanding of what's real and what should we do, right? Because those are kind of the big questions that are operative right now, is like, what's going on and what should we do about it? And there's huge amounts of disagreement and tribalism and things like that are playing into that. There's science that's playing into that. There's anecdotes that are playing into that. And all of those have a certain degree of legitimacy. And we're trying to put that hierarchy together, each of us, for ourselves, about who do I trust? How do I trust? What do I trust? And what do I do? And so what I'm hearing, you know, I think even if our individual kind of metaphors or our individual grappling with that doesn't necessarily map to everybody, I think what I'm hearing is the engagement in that process, right? And, you know, ideally it would be great if I had a single answer about this is how you do that. But it's very much more about, I think, being in that process and trying to be really, really honest and trying to get better and better at it all the time. And I think being really committed to that process as a process seems to me to be operative right now. So
that's great. I think we'll end on this because it's getting late. There's so much more I wanted to go at the Lunacy Lockdown, pick a couple of the facts out to have Stephen look at them. We've done this many times over. They're the same kind of arguments. But just to use as an illustration in my mind why I'm wrapping this stuff around to this kind of story, priority versus science, is that in that exposition that this gentleman wrote, it looks as though over and over there is a softening of the edges of the scientific research that end up portraying a particular case for him. And in the end, I know we say this tongue in cheek, but it actually is a serious concept and almost a principle I'm now living by, you guys. I'm creating these core principles in my life. And I think it's okay. It's complicated. It's become a very core principle that absolutely. And there's all these different caveats, right? And that's life, and that's okay, and it's beautiful. And the more you surrender to it, I think the more freedom I feel in engaging real, genuine dialogue. And that's what I'm feeling. So we've got in now. It's 59 minutes in. It is the longest episode ever. My wife is calling for me to come upstairs. She has a class that she has to go to. Thanks for hanging in there, guys. It's been awesome. I love this episode. Fun to go deep dive on this stuff. Again, if you reach out to Stephen, StephenKissler on Twitter, Matt@livingthereal.com. Let me know how things are going on your side of the world or country, wherever you may be. Check out livingthereal.com/momentummatters. Get that free template and have a series of emails that'll be going out or should go out automatically. I'll tell you how to get going and do something great in the next 3 months of your life. And we'll see you next week. Take care. Bye-bye.